Well, good morning. If you are in this room and you are listening, which is everybody, I just want to say that I'm so grateful that you're here today. I'm so grateful that out of all of the different ways that you could choose to spend your Sunday, that you're here. And even more than that, I'm grateful that you choose to be part of this community. There's something that I've been convicted of over the last little while, and that is that not only are we a better community because you as an individual are here, but that we as a community are able to experience the reality of who God is more fully because you are here. So I'm grateful that you're here, and I'm grateful that you're part of this community. I'm grateful that we get to experience and understand who God is more fully because you as an individual created in the image of God are here. We are in a series going through Jonah, and so 2 weeks ago we did a long read. We read all the way through the story and spent some time talking about it with one another. Last week we accomplished a whole three verses and unpacked that pretty thoroughly and walked away with this idea that Nineveh was like the worst of the worst of the worst, and yet God loved them, and God wanted to spare them from their own wicked and destructive ways. And we looked at this idea that sometimes faithfulness to God will look like unfaithfulness to your people. That Jonah, in going and saving the Ninevites, who were going to be the ones to destroy his, or to conquer his people, being faithful to what God called him to was being unfaithful to his people. But had Jonah not been faithful to God, that would have been faithful, looked like faithfulness to his people. And just the weird place that being a peacemaker and living out a call of faithfulness to God will place on our life. Today, we're going to continue on in Jonah. We're going to cover a little more than three verses. Somebody last week was like, okay, so are we going to spend like a year in Jonah? No, just a few weeks. But I think there's some really, really good, important stuff to cover here. So we're going to pause for a word of prayer, and then we'll dive into this chapter. Loving God, we give you thanks for the gift of today and the chance that we have to gather together with our sisters and with our brothers and people who may think like us and people who may not think like us, and the fact that you call us one. God, we're grateful that something happens in the community of Christ that can build bridges across whatever differences we may have. God, as we open the scriptures today, we recognize that your Spirit is here among us. God, would your Spirit be at work in us, shaping us and forming us into the image of Jesus. We pray all this in the name of Jesus. Amen. Occasionally, Allie and I will have disagreements over the best directions to a spot in town, or maybe even the name of something in town. So, you know, we have our own tasks that we run throughout the day, and so sometimes we drive separately to something, and occasionally we'll be driving there together, and the other one will scoff when one turns left instead of turning right and say, "You think that's the best way?" Or we'll have like a disagreement, and one of us will be very, very set on the fact that this road is called this, and the other one will say, no, that road is definitely called this. Or sometimes either of us will have like this weird click in our brain where we'll just like continually call the store or a store or something the wrong name, like calling Dollar General on the corner Family Dollar or vice versa. You know, let's just recognize that we all have these quirks, right? Like we all have those things that we call the wrong name, and for whatever reason our brain just won't click that it's Dollar General and not Family Dollar, you know what I mean? And I also want to acknowledge that I am fairly dense, and so Allie is always much better at picking up my thing than I am hers. I'll be stumbling over words, and she's like, "Ah, yes, Dollar General," and I'm like, "Yes, yes, you're right." Where she'll be processing, and I'm like, "I have no idea what you're talking about. Sorry, I'm just missing it." So, before I begin, I am dense. Allie is much brighter than I am. So, a while back, Allie and I ran a half marathon, and so we were looking at training plans for this half marathon, but we immediately realized that we needed some like pre-training plans because the training plans were running miles, and we were doing good to run a Mayol. So we did some pre-training, and this was over the winter, and it was cold out, and so we spent a lot of time running at the Louisville Y. That's the closest gym with an indoor track, and I like absolutely hate treadmills. So we spent a lot of time running there, but once it started to get warm out, we were looking for places to run outside. And we were given some advice that it's best to find a loop that you can run because you're running, again, miles, and it's best to just be able to check out and not have to worry about cars or my greatest fear, which are loose dogs. So we sat down and we started brainstorming some ideas of where we could run. And up to this point, we had run at Monument together, Monument Park. And typically, this looked like just running around the driveway. Occasionally, if we were feeling bold, we'd try to run up the steps and make it about halfway before we collapsed. This was typically where we would run together. Now, Allie had run with a friend at Monument, and Monument has a trail that connects under 12th Street to Stadium. But, key detail, she had only ever done that through Monument. Always started at Monument, ran to Stadium, finished at Monument. I had run at Stadium by myself, but it was always at Stadium. I had always started at Stadium, run at Stadium, left at Stadium. So we sit down and we start to discuss where we can start running, and I say, oh, well, Stadium's a good spot. And she goes, what's Stadium? And I said, it's just north of Monument. Oh, so Monument. I go, no, it's different than Monument. Okay, so we're talking and we're trying to figure this out, and each time she's going to say Stadium, she says Monument. I said, no, Stadium. Okay, so we keep talking, and she'll say Monument, and I say, ever so kindly and ever so gently now, Stadium. Yeah, okay. We're talking Monument. Stadium? And now you can tell, like, this is starting to get annoying, right? As it would be for anybody, right? So we end that conversation, and later on, we're getting ready to go run at Stadium, and we're driving on Fulton, heading north. And what road is it that you would need to turn to Monument, like 6th Street, 8th Street, something like that? Anyways, we're approaching that, and Allie says, don't you need to turn here? And I say, no, we're going to Stadium. She's like, right, you need to turn here. I was like, no. And she's like, yeah, you need to turn here. I was like, okay. So I turn, and we pull up to Monument, and we stop, and she says, okay, cool. Do you know the trail? Do you know how far we need to run? I say, no. She said, I thought you looked it up. I said, I did. What do you mean? I looked it up for Stadium. And you can imagine, all of those feelings from that previous conversation rose to the surface, and we did not get off to that run on a good start. But there's good news in this. Never once again did we mix up the fact that Stadium Park is north of 12th Street and Monument is south of 12th Street, right? Again, I'm much more dense than Hallie. Had the roles been reversed, she would have totally figured out what I was talking about. Anyways, so why was there some sort of conflict in this situation? Because locations matter, spaces matter, destinations matter, directions matter. We know this in trying to figure out directions or spaces with our spouse, like which park we're going to go to and run. But we also know this with our work environments, right? You can imagine the embarrassment if you showed up at the north branch of your work only to find that there was a staff meeting where everybody was at the south branch, right? Spaces and destinations matter. You also know that, like, working in, and some of you will, like, start getting some anxiety as soon as I describe this room. If you were to work in a room that is totally white, with white plastic tables, with no windows and fluorescent lights, you would know that that is not an environment that fosters creativity, right? Because environments matter. Spaces matter. When we first got here, I tried to just not do anything to the office here, which had been kind of a storage room, so I was like, yeah, no big deal. I couldn't get a thing done in there, and at one point, Allie was like, it's not your space yet. And I was like, oh. So I painted it, built myself a desk, and I was like, oh, this is awesome. Spaces matter, right? Or you can imagine going to your childhood home, and if your siblings are there, like, instantly, you're back to being 12 years old, right, and bickering with everybody, right? Again, spaces matter. Or if you return to a space where there was a particularly trying or difficult season, you know that just simply being there can foster all of these emotions and bring back all of those feelings that were in that place. When I was a junior in high school, we moved from my childhood home to a nearby city, and that's where I spent like the hardest 6 months of my life. That's where my mom underwent chemo, that's where she died, and like even just driving past it on the highway brings back all of that. Why? Because locations matter. Spaces matter. Destinations matter. Directions matter. And the writers of Scripture are not immune to that. They know that they can just subtly work in these details about spaces or locations or destinations or directions. And they know that just by simply stating this, that they can foster and create all sorts of emotion and create all sorts of imagery with just a few words by noting the location, the space, the destination, the direction. And the book of Jonah is no exception to that. But before we get there, we need to cover a bit of chapter one so that we can get kind of the big picture of what the author's doing here with directions. So last week we looked at this idea that the story opens up with this line, "Now the word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai, saying, 'Go at once to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against its wickedness. Cry out against the blood on their hands.'" We said that this is a story about a prophet, right? God has a message and God selects somebody called a prophet to take this message to a certain people to share this message. And this message was to go to Nineveh, this great wicked city, and to cry out against their injustice. But we're told Jonah did something quite opposite. So verse 3 says, "But Jonah set out to flee to Tarshish," essentially like the opposite direction. Jonah set out to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. He went down to Joppa and found a ship going to Tarshish, so he paid his fare and went on board to go with them to Tarshish, away from the presence of the Lord. Now, again, in the ancient world, you didn't have bold, italics, underline, so the way that you would draw attention to something is by repeating it. Essentially, what happens here is God places a call on Jonah's life to go and cry out against the Ninevites, and Jonah says, "Nope, not doing it," and Jonah is trying to escape from the presence of the Lord, away from the presence of the Lord. This is why Jonah is on his way to Tarshish, to get away from the presence of the Lord, because to get away from the presence of the Lord is to get away from the call that God has placed on his life. A really key detail, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So Jonah goes down to Joppa, gets on a ship, goes to Tarshish, essentially like the farthest place in the known world away from Nineveh. And we're told, "But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and such a mighty storm came upon the sea that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners," or the sailors, "were afraid, and each cried to his God. They threw the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. Jonah, meanwhile, had gone down into the hold of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep." So we get this imagery that Jonah gets on the ship, they set sail, and there's this great, mighty storm that's like threatening to break up the ship. And everybody's freaking out, except Jonah, right? Jonah's fast asleep. But at the top of the ship, we have all of these sailors, and we're told that they cry out to all of their gods. Now, the way that gods and religion worked was that every region had their own god, they had their own religion. And so the imagery here is that this is a very vast, diverse crew made up of all sorts of different people, and it's essentially like a process of elimination. Oh, you're from the west. Cry out to your western gods. Oh, nothing. Okay, you're from the east. Cry out to your eastern gods. Oh, nothing. You're from the north. Cry out to your northern gods. Oh, nothing. You're from the south. Cry out to your southern gods. Oh, nothing. What in the world's going on? Well, Jonah misses out on all of this, again, because he's fast asleep. So the captain of the ship goes down into the hold of the ship, into the belly of the ship. And he says to him, "What are you doing sound asleep? Get up, call on your God. Perhaps the God will spare us a thought so that we do not perish." Now there's some irony that's at play here. A little bit of comedic relief in this dramatic sailor's tale. But we miss it because we speak English. So we established at the beginning that there was this call on Jonah's life. God comes to Jonah and says, "Go at once to Nineveh, that great city, and cry out against it." This is the call that God has placed on Jonah's life, and Jonah is fleeing, trying to run away from this call. Jonah is trying to get as far away from this call that God has placed on his life, this call to go and cry out. Here, as Jonah is fast asleep in the middle of the ship, the captain comes to him and says, "Get up and call on your God." Now this is where we miss it. Because the same word in the Hebrew is used here for go and get up, and the same word is used for cry out and call. The author's trying to get this point across that Jonah is trying to escape from the presence of God. Jonah is trying to escape this call that God has placed on his life. But no matter where Jonah goes, he cannot escape this call to get up and cry out. Again, in the midst of this dramatic sailor story, there's this little bit of irony, a little bit of comedic relief of like, Jonah, no matter how hard he tried, just cannot get away from this call. So the sailors are on the top of the ship, and they've done all of their praying, done all of their crying out to their gods, and nothing seems to be working. And so we're told that they cast lots, which are essentially like divine dice. It's a way of like trying to figure out what the gods are saying. And the lots fall on Jonah, which means that the storm is the result of Jonah. So they go down on the ship and they grab him and they pull him up and they begin to interrogate him. And they say, who are you? Where are you from? What is your profession? Jonah says, I'm a Hebrew and I worship Yahweh, the God of heaven, the creator of the land and the sea. And he tells them that he's on the run. So they're trying to figure out what to do. And they say, Jonah, what do we need to do to calm the sea down? And Jonah, I don't know, picture him with his hand in his pockets. He's like, I don't know, just throw me over, I guess. Pretty nonchalant about his life at this point, right? But the sailors like have this respect, this dignity for his life, and they're like, okay, we're going to try something else. So it's all hands on deck. They're rowing and rowing and rowing and trying to get to sea. But the imagery that we get here is that God is saying to Jonah, you can't get off that easy. You can't escape this call that I've placed on your life. It's not as simple as just getting to shore. And so the sailors finally give up. They offer up this prayer to God and say, spare us from the blood on our hands. And they toss him overboard. And the storm stops, and they begin to offer up offerings to Yahweh. And then our favorite part of the story, this big old fish comes and swallows up Jonah, right? Now, this is a pretty dramatic sailor's story. We picture it like in a pub off of the coast of Iceland, right? Like this is the setting in which the story is being told. You would get that if you had been to Iceland. I'm realizing that now. But there's so much more happening here than just a dramatic tale. Again, if you remember, we opened by talking about how locations matter, spaces matter, destinations matter, directions matter. See, all throughout this chapter, we see that there is one particular direction in which Jonah is going, and that is the direction of down. We might call this the downward descent of Jonah. So we see in chapter 1, verse 3, it's actually ironic because if we go back just a little bit further, it begins with this call to arise or get up. There's a movement of going up, but Jonah does the complete opposite. And Jonah goes down to Joppa. In verse 5, we see Jonah had gone down into the hold of the ship. Again, continuing this journey of going down. We see later in verse 5 that Jonah was fast asleep. Not exactly down, but the word that's used here for sleep is the same sort of sleep that somebody has on their deathbed. Like this like deep sort of unconscious sleep where you could just easily drift off into death. Again, it's this like moving away from consciousness, moving away from God. And then we see in 15 that they picked Jonah up and threw him into the sea. Again, this descent down into the depths of the sea. And then if we can creep into chapter 2 just a little bit, we see that in the belly of the fish, Jonah is offering up this prayer, this hymn, this song to God. And in the midst of that, Jonah says, I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. The imagery here is that Jonah just keeps going down and down and down and down and down. This is the downward descent of Jonah. Now, if we understand how those in the ancient Near East, this place in history, understood how the universe was made, how the cosmos were organized, this begins to communicate something a little bit more to us. So here's a picture of how they understood the world to be. Probably a bit flat earthers. And so they saw that the earth here was kind of in the center of everything. And the further up you went, the further you were getting into the holy of holies. The further up you went, the holier it was, because the higher and higher you went, this was the dwelling of the divine. And so as you would get away from earth, as you would continually move up and up and up and up and up, the holier and holier it got, because you were getting closer and closer to the dwelling place of God. But the opposite then was true. The further down you went, the further it was seen that you were going away from the presence of God. We see that just below the earth is the sea, and then just below the sea is the underworld, or as the Hebrew scriptures call them, Sheol, the state of nothingness. And the imagery here is, again, the farther you go down, the further into the depths of the depths of the depths that you're going, and you're getting further and further and further away from the presence of God. And so we get to this place in chapter 2, verse 6, where he says, I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. This is kind of a convoluted phrase, but the imagery here is that Jonah had gone so far down into creation that he had escaped creation itself. That he had been trying to flee from the presence of God so much that the only place that he could go to escape the presence of God was out of creation itself, and it locked its doors behind him and wouldn't let him back in. That as Jonah's sitting in the belly of the fish, he feels like he is so far removed from the presence of God that it's as if he was out of creation itself, away from God's very presence. It's important to recognize that the story begins with a simple step down. Jonah, in turning away from God's call, went down to Joppa. And what we see happening is kind of a snowball effect of that one decision. And this is sort of the nature of how this word sin works. It often begins with an active step towards something, or an active step away from the way that God desires things to be. But as we make that step away, there begins to be the snowball effect of the consequences of that choice. And what once started out as an active step away has now become sort of a passive pulling us down and down and down and down and down until it feels like we are away from the presence of God, locked out of creation itself. We might call this a state of Jonah's exile. But the good news for Jonah, and I would say the good news for us, is that the story doesn't end there. Chapter 2, verse 6 says, I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me. Again, forever, Jonah felt like he was removed, locked out of creation, locked out of the presence of God. But the very next line says, yet you brought my life up from the pit, O Lord, my God. Jonah was at this state where he felt like he had gone into the depths of the depths of the depths, that he went down, down, down to the point where he was out of creation itself, that he was away from the presence of God, that the bars had closed over him, that he was banished from the presence of God. And yet it was there where God showed up, out of the presence of God, out of the state of creation, and grabbed his life and brought him back from the depths. Even in the depths of the depths, even at the farthest point of creation, even to the point of being shut out of creation in the presence of God itself, there God met Jonah. It was there that Jonah experienced redemption. And it was there, we might even say, that Jonah experienced resurrection. See, Jonah's past choices and decisions might have brought him to this place, but Jonah's past choices and decisions did not have to keep him in that place. And I think the same can be said for us. We may have made a choice at one point to actively step away from the call of God in our life, or to flee from the presence of God. And that one choice may have led into a snowball effect of the consequences of that. And we felt like we went down, 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 fleeing from the presence of God to the point where we were locked out of creation itself and locked out of the presence of God's very self. And the choices and the decisions that we might have made might have brought us to that place. But the good news is that the choices and the decisions that we once made no longer have to keep us there. Because it's at this place of being locked out of creation itself that we can experience the redemption and the resurrection of God. What we see from the story of the downward descent of Jonah is that the only place that we can escape the presence of God is outside of creation itself. And even there, there is grace. Jonah, in trying to flee from the presence of God, getting away from this call of God, knew that there was just one direction, and that was down, 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 out of creation itself. But as soon as he was locked out, that's where he met the grace of God. I recognize that this makes no sense, right? Like, if you read it, you're like, okay, the only place where we can escape the presence of God is outside of creation itself. And even there, there is grace? I'll admit it, I wrote it. It's gobbledygook, though, right? And let me tell you, this is how grace works. It doesn't make sense. And it comes at the place where we feel most far gone. Now, I think there is a gift that the author of Jonah gives to us in this story. And as soon as I say it, you're going to think, yeah, I think I'll return that gift. So bear with me, I'll explain it in just a second. But I think the gift that the author of Jonah extends to us is to read ourselves into the story of Jonah, to see ourselves in the character of Jonah. Here's what I mean by this. I think as we think about this story, it's important that we ask ourselves a few questions. The first question that we can ask ourselves is, in what ways have I set out to flee from the presence of God? This is the first thing that Jonah does. He hears this call and he flees from the presence of God. I recognize that there are a number of reasons that you or I may want to flee from the presence of God. Maybe it's some sort of intellectual dispute, right? You just can't figure this out, and so, well, then the whole faith can't make sense, and so you want to step away. Or maybe you've experienced some sort of loss or some sort of trauma or some sort of injustice, and you think, well, certainly God can't be good, and so you make that conscious decision to step away from God. But whatever it is, for whatever reason, there's some intentional fleeing from the presence of God. The second question, am I trying to escape some sort of difficult call that God has placed on my life? This is some sort of definitive direction that you feel like God is calling you to. Maybe it's to move to a new part of town, or to start a new job or a new career, or maybe it's starting or ending some sort of relationship, or saying a no or a yes in your life. You feel that there's this clear calling to do something, and you think, nope, I'd rather not do that. Third question then, is there a correlation between the decisions in my life over the last while and the angst that I feel towards God right now? What I mean by this is, as you think about the last season of your life and this angst, this absence of God, if you will, or this coldness from God, as you think back to like when that began, were there any decisions that you were making in your life? Were there any choices that could have led to this angst that you feel? Now, a quick side note. Often people will take this and turn this and say that if you don't feel the presence of God, that there is some unrepentant sin in your life. I don't think that's always the case. I think it's perfectly normal to go through seasons where it may just feel like you're going through the motions. But I think it would be a grave mistake to throw all of that out and say that there may not be a reason with some sort of decision that we made that has led to this feeling absent from the presence of God. Okay, so at this point you're like, okay, that's definitely a gift I'd rather return. Let me explain. My goal in asking these questions is not to add shame or guilt or judgment into your life. I think there are enough sources of shame and guilt and judgment in the world. That's not really anything that I'm interested in. But the goal of asking these questions leads us to what we might call revelation, having our eyes open to something. I don't know about you, but I get so caught up in the day-to-day, the moment-by-moment of my life that I forget that there are seasons, that there are trajectories that happen within my life. And I forget that sometimes what's happening now, how I'm feeling in this moment, can be correlated to something that happened months ago. See, what we see with the story of Jonah is that he's fast asleep in the ship in the midst of this great storm. Like, he doesn't seem to be piecing this together. It's not until his eyes are open that he can begin to see what's going on. And I think for us, sometimes it's only when our eyes are open, when we've had this revelation, that we can begin to see what's happening in our lives. And it's then that we can begin to experience this radical, redemptive, resurrecting grace of God. So wherever you find yourself this morning, whether it's fleeing from the presence of God, again, because of some injustice that you've experienced or some sort of just things not lining up with your faith, or if you're trying to escape some sort of difficult call in your life, or if you find yourself in this moment of angst because of some sort of decision that you might have made and the snowball effect of the choices and decisions in your life, and if you feel like you have been locked out of creation itself and that you've been locked out of the presence of God, let me remind you that the only place where you can escape the presence of God is outside of creation itself. And even there is grace. And yes, it doesn't make sense. And yes, it's absolutely gobbledygook. But that, my friends, is how grace works. Let's pray. God, we give you thanks that you are a God of grace, and that you are a God of redemption, and that you are a God of resurrection. God, we give you thanks that the choices and decisions that we've made, whether that be an intentional step down or just the passive results of those choices that we've made, that those choices and those decisions don't have to continue to keep us in the place that we find ourselves. But that it's often at the worst of the worst, at the depths of the depths, that you are there to meet us and extend grace to us, to bring us up from the belly of the fish. And it's there that we can experience new life, and it's there that we experience the with God life that you extend to us through your kingdom. God, I pray for each and every one of us here that if we find ourselves in the season of going down, 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 that your Spirit would open our eyes and remind us that grace is available at any point along the way, and that you're there waiting for us, embracing us and loving us and bringing us back to wholeness. God, may we as a church embody this love that you have, that for anybody among us in our community that may feel like they're on this downward descent, this wandering, this journeying, God, that we can extend that same sort of grace to them and welcome them in and love them to wholeness. God, we give you thanks for this grace and this love that you extend to us. I pray this in your name. Amen.